From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor DeSantis's desk piles up with new bills this week.
Expands the safe haven law by allowing the use of 911 to surrender a baby, which protects those without access to transportation.
Also this week, technically, Florida's new abortion restriction has exceptions, but the legal language about them is vague.
There's been a deep concern among pro-life groups for some time that any exception will turn into the, you know, exception that swallows the rule, right?
We'll also have several stories on what might lie ahead when it comes to this year's hurricane season, and we'll warn you in advance, the news isn't pretty. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Governor Ron DeSantis received over 27 bills from the Florida legislature this week. Tristan Wood reports he has until June 5th to act on them.
The bills affect a wide range of areas in Florida, from homeowners associations to dentists. One bill would expand last year's Safe Haven law, which made it legal to surrender unwanted infants as long as they are given up unharmed to certain drop-off locations, including hospitals and fire stations. Lakeland Republican Representative Jennifer Kennedy says the bill will give parents more time to turn over their children up to 30 days after they were born, as well as other changes.
HB 775 expands the safe haven law by allowing the use of 911 to surrender a baby, which protects those without access to transportation.
As we approach hurricane season, another bill would ensure Floridians will be able to make hurricane protection improvements without having to worry about their homeowners association. While an HOA can enforce requirements around the color and style of a home, Merritt Island Republican Representative Tyler Sirois says his bill will make sure HOAs can't ban features like storm shutters.
Wanting to make sure that we have our homeowners associations in our state not in a position where they're doing anything to prohibit or to create hurdles to people that want to harden their home in preparation for a storm.
And another bill would require all dentists and orthodontists to display their license visibly in their practice. It also requires in-person examinations before certain procedures are conducted, like correcting malpositioned teeth. Trey Lawrence, CEO of the American Association of Orthodontists, says his organization supports the bill.
We strongly believe that this bill is a major step toward protecting patients who receive orthodontic treatment and other types of dental treatment. We believe that this bill will give the dental board the jurisdiction and the authority that it needs to protect those patients the way that it was intended to.
So far, DeSantis has signed most of the bills that have made it to his desk from the session that ended in March. He has only vetoed two bills this year, the ones related to the controversial social media ban for minors. He eventually signed revamped versions of those. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida now bans most abortions after 6 weeks. While some say the law puts the lives of women in danger, others argue provisions are in place to protect them. Regan McCarthy reports debate is growing around the country as people question what it means when abortion laws say they include exceptions to protect the life of the mother.
It's a harder question than one might think. And for Rachel Humphrey, the stakes are high.
I really didn't want to end up in prison. It was not what I hoped for when I went through medical school.
Humphrey has spent decades treating people with high-risk pregnancies here in Florida, a state where doctors who participate in an abortion other than what's allowed by law could lose their medical licenses and face felony criminal charges.
I have had doctors in my area say, you know what? I know that this condition, the baby could never survive. Or I know with this condition, the mom is clearly at a threat continuing her pregnancy, but I can't take care of any of it because I just don't understand the complexity of these laws.
Humphrey says on the surface, an exemption to protect the life of the pregnant person makes sense.
But what it means is that they're ascribing to me and my colleagues superhuman ability to predict outcomes that we don't necessarily have that ability to predict.
Humphrey recently cared for a woman who had survived a heart attack not long before becoming pregnant.
I can't tell the patient with any precision what the chance is that she'll die during the pregnancy.
Humphrey says conditions common in pregnancy, like hypertension and bleeding, could put this patient's life at risk. But is that enough for Florida's exceptions to apply? It's not clear, Humphrey says, but she says the person who should be making the decision is the patient.
Let's say that this patient who's had heart attacks actually has children at home and has a great fear of dying because her mother died in the mid-40s. Is it right to say that the politicians know better than any specific circumstance and that this patient has to take risks because a doctor doesn't know what percentage might exist hidden in this law? It's just too vague.
Mary Ziegler, a UC Davis law professor, says some of the confusion might not be accidental.
There's been a deep concern among pro-life groups for some time that any exception will turn into the, you know, exception that swallows the rule, right? That it'll turn into a loophole. So most of these exceptions are designed to be fairly difficult to use.
The idea that these laws are confusing and difficult to apply isn't just among doctors. Political leaders at the highest level, like Vice President Kamala Harris, say it too. Harris came to Jacksonville earlier this month and had this to say.
Folks, since Roe was overturned, I have met women who were refused care during a miscarriage. I met a woman who was turned away from an emergency room, and it was only when she developed sepsis that she received care.
Some abortion opponents say confusion about the life of the mother exception is coming from statements like Harris's. They say that's the reason doctors and patients are afraid. To clear up some of that confusion, the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration issued a set of temporary emergency rules. The agency's leader posted on social media the rules are needed because abortion access advocates are, quote, lying for political gain. And that's something Kelsey Pritchard with the group Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America agrees with.
It's pretty clear when you listen to any Democrat talk about the issue of abortion, why it's needed. And unfortunately, it's because they've been relying on this false talking point that women will die if you don't vote the way they want you to vote, or if you put in place a heartbeat law.
But Dr. Rachel Humphrey says the agency's guidance makes things more confusing. For one thing, it only addresses three conditions.
I'm just rolling my eyes and cringing because yet again, here we are with layer upon layer of rules and layer upon layer of government intervention, which is not resulting in clarity or in better care.
President Biden's administration has also tried clearing things up. It says a federal law that requires doctors to stabilize patients applies to abortion, even if the procedure is barred by state law. Conservative states are pushing back, and a case is now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in Florida, voters will have a chance to decide in November whether to enshrine abortion access into the state constitution. I'm Regan McCarthy.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has issued its busiest preseason forecast ever for the Atlantic hurricane season that starts in a week. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich reports.
NOAA forecasters say weather patterns and high ocean temperatures are conspiring this year to potentially produce another dangerous Atlantic hurricane season. They're forecasting up to 25 named storms and as many as 13 hurricanes. 4 to 7 could become major hurricanes. And once again, they worry about fierce storms that give little time to prepare.
Every Category 5 storm that made landfall in the United States in the last 100 years, ready? Is a tropical storm or less 3 days prior. The big ones are fast.
Ken Graham is director of the National Weather Service.
On those Category 5s, the average lead time is 50 hours. Preparedness got to be ready.
The high odds of a La Nina weather pattern could also be potentially more dangerous for Florida and other places around the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico. Matt Rosenkrantz is NOAA's lead season forecaster.
That's for those most notable wind shear reductions that allow those storms to kind of really stay together.
La Niñas typically weaken atmospheric winds that help shred hurricanes. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
And as we just heard, hurricane season does start next week. The official forecast is a doozy. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicting up to 25 named storms, up to 13 of them hurricanes, possibly 7 of those could be at least Category 3 status. Florida's utility leaders now say they're responding to a trend of stronger and more unpredictable hurricanes. And all of that preparation comes at a cost. State regulators heard their presentations this week ahead of hurricane season, as we hear from Gina Jordan.
We no longer feel comfortable that a Category 1 is going to stay a Category 1.
Armando Pimentel is president and CEO of Florida Power and Light, which provides electricity for nearly 6 million accounts across half of the state.
But the storms certainly appear to be bigger and stronger now than they have been in the past. And we and others have been surprised by the increase of intensity of those storms in a very, very short period of time.
Take Idalia, for example. It zoomed through warm Gulf waters last August, going ashore in Keaton Beach in the Big Bend. It quickly escalated into a Category 4 storm before dropping to a 3 at landfall. Pimentel says it's not the first time a storm has intensified so unexpectedly, and he notes the waters are warm again this year.
Understanding that it's important for your customers to have power on as quickly as possible after a storm, we and others are going to be a little bit more conservative than we've been in the past, right? Because now we can't miss a Category 1 storm turning into a Category 4 or 5 storm and not being well prepared.
Utility leaders told the Florida Public Service Commission it's becoming more of a challenge to line up assistance from neighboring states when a rapidly intensifying storm could hit their area. As a result, nearby states that usually send help are holding on to their manpower and resources longer.
We find ourselves nowadays, because of the unpredictability of these hurricanes, you're planning for a circumstance that's worse than's being forecasted. And you're also receiving resources that are coming from much farther away than they probably were coming from historically.
Tampa Electric Company President and CEO Archie Collins says crews came from as far away as Illinois, Virginia, and Arkansas to help after Idalia.
It is becoming an increasingly difficult game to figure out how to find that balance between being well prepared and not overspending on planning for an impending hurricane.
The News Service of Florida reports the state's 4 private electric utilities, FPL, Tampa Electric, Duke Energy Florida, and Florida Public Utilities, can pass along the cost of hurricane preparation and recovery to customers.
Storm preparedness is right up there with our commitment to safety, reliability, resiliency, prudent spending. And that is what allows us to basically stage an army. And that's what all of us have to do.
Duke Florida President Melissa Satius says storm prep is a huge part of what they do, and bringing in crews is a significant expense.
We are literally staging an army. We've got to house them, we got to feed them, we got to get their clothes washed, and of course we need to help keep them safe.
The point you're really hitting home is increased the intensification of storms, and that to be prepared for that is going to necessarily be more costly.
Florida Public Service Commissioner Gabriella Pasadomo said utilities will have to balance the needs of customers with trying to navigate storms that are becoming more unpredictable. I'm Gina Jordan.
The burning of fossil fuels has been trapping heat in the atmosphere, leading to extreme heat, sea level rise, and more powerful storms. Now a father has written a how-to guide for his son on living in a warming world. Bill Weir is an anchor and the chief climate correspondent at CNN. His book, Life as We Know It Can Be, was written for his son River, who was born in 2020. WUSF's Jessica Mazzaro spoke with Weir about his book, which also offers coping skills.
Based on all your reporting, what do you think is the biggest hurdle combating climate change right now?
Human nature. It's our psychology. This is no longer a story about the forces of nature or energy streams or physics. That's the main actor that we're all living through, but how bad it gets or how good it gets depends on human behavior and decisions.
That kind of shift the language around climate change, like Carbonzilla. Can you explain that language shift?
I've been frustrated as a climate storyteller about our inability to use the proper language, the word choice around this existential threat. And global warming isn't all that scary. People love warmth and the greenhouse effect. People aren't afraid of greenhouses. People say we should be able to mobilize like in World War II, but this is a very different challenge than raising an army to fight an obvious scary foe. And when I was sort of bemoaning this to a fisherman scientist up in Maine, he just blurted out, it's a Godzilla. We've created a Godzilla out of fossil fuels. We've unleashed this monster from the bowels of the earth. And at first, it helped us do the heavy lifting. It built modern society. But that monster has gotten so big, it's destroying everything outside.
It's clear from your book that you do have a sense of hope for the future, right? Like, can you talk about what solutions bring you the most hope? Do we all have to become like, you know, living in Babcock Ranch, the first solar powered town in America? Or is this something greater than that?
What gives me the most hope is this invisible industrial revolution that's happening. All of these amazing ideas are just now being uncorked, and private money is chasing government money, and countries around the world are decarbonizing in real meaningful terms. But I worry that it's not fast enough and it won't happen enough at scale. I worry that the destruction that will come from these unnatural disasters could further balkanize the country into, you know, different regions that really believe in the climate science and those who don't. Unfortunately, the Goldilocks Earth that I grew up on, we've moved out of that, and we're not sure how this new planet works. And there are days when it's very scary, but those are the times I argue when it's most imperative for us to act locally, to lean across the fence and talk to a neighbor that you know you might not agree on when it comes to the ballot box, but you share a love of a hiking trail or a fishing hole or a reef or a beach, and you can communicate around the threats to those things that you both hold dear. And then maybe the conversation evolves into the politics around it, or what can we do as citizens, as consumers, to save this thing that we all agree is worth saving? That's where I find my hope, in the helpers and those kinds of conversations as communities build for a more resilient future.
That was CNN's Bill Weir speaking to WUSF's Jessica Mazaros. You can read Florida highlights from his book at WFSU.org. Florida is one of the first states in the country to develop its own human trafficking hotline mandated by a new state law. That happened after a bipartisan group of 35 attorneys general asked Congress to look into the National Human Trafficking Hotline. It's funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. As Margie Menzel reports, their complaint is that the national hotline doesn't report enough of its cases to law enforcement.
The only way to stop trafficking is to take the head off the snake and put traffickers behind bars.
That's Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody. She's describing her discovery that Catherine Chen, the CEO of Polaris, a nonprofit that runs the National Human Trafficking Hotline, had said, quote, "We can't arrest our way out of this problem."
And so when I heard that as the attorney general, first and foremost, I met with that leader and demanded to know why tips were delayed to law enforcement, why tips weren't being given directly to our law enforcement. And they said they were more focused on victim-centered approaches than they were on helping law enforcement put criminals behind bars.
Chen, who has been CEO of Polaris since 2020, says human trafficking affects nearly 28 million people worldwide and garners about $236 billion in illicit profits, too big for a single approach to work. What's more, she says, it's not a question of a trafficked person being kidnapped and then rescued. It's far more complex than that.
Some people are in relationships with their traffickers. Some people are parents alongside their traffickers. Some people, their traffickers know where their loved ones live, where their children live. And so it's never quite that cut and dry to be able to say there's a moment when you're taken and there's a moment when you get rescued.
Chen says the national hotline reports about 30% of its calls to law enforcement. These include all cases involving the abuse, neglect, or trafficking of a minor, which are reported to child welfare as well as to law enforcement. Other cases involve violence or the imminent threat of harm or death, if an adult victim of trafficking asks them to call, or if an adult victim asks someone else to call for them. Chen says the other 70% of their calls are either people who don't want law enforcement involved or who are calling to get access to services.
We are, I think, very expressly and specifically in partnership with law enforcement agencies. And so I really do want to be clear that we're certainly not opposed to law enforcement. And we work very closely with state attorneys generals, with district attorneys, with federal law enforcement. But first and foremost, we respect that victims and survivors have to have agency.
The Florida House of Representatives voted unanimously for the bill that created the new state hotline. Actually, the function of reporting human trafficking was added to an already established hotline that also reports food stamp fraud and gasoline pump fraud. Orlando Democratic State Representative Anna Escamani, who voted for the bill, says she doesn't think Florida's trafficking hotline will be in conflict with the national trafficking hotline.
I'm hopeful not. I mean, I will say preventing human trafficking overwhelmingly is an issue that is incredibly bipartisan when there is collective alignment to do what's right. And there's also an agreement that it is a problem in Florida since our two top industries are tourism and agriculture, and these are the two top industries that are most vulnerable to trafficking.
Escamani adds that many people trapped in these criminal operations may not speak English or have documentation. They may have come from another country to escape being trafficked there. So their dealings with Florida law enforcement must be very thoughtful.
Because there is a fear of deportation. With that said, the federal government does have a visa process for victims of crime. But not every person knows that, and not every law enforcement officer is trained on that.
Victor Williams is a retired agent with Homeland Security Investigations who has 14 years of experience in human trafficking. He's also the founder and president of Quest to Freedom, an anti-trafficking nonprofit in Miami. He says both the national hotline and the law enforcement sides of the debate could improve their games. He called the national hotline recently and had to wait for an hour.
It's not about bad-mouthing Polaris, because they're the only issue I have with them is the amount of time it's taking them to answer the call. But they are doing their job in the mentality of victim-centered, trauma-informed. If the victim don't want law enforcement notified, then we don't notify law enforcement.
He says law enforcement officers across the board should be trained, not just those who work with trafficking task forces, and that they should learn how to make their cases without putting victims on the stand.
I can't force the victim to get on a stand if they don't want to. And I definitely don't want to put a traumatized person on a stand. So what am I left with then? Having to figure out how to put that bad guy in jail without using that victim.
Williams also points out that most other states don't have their own hotlines, so they rely on Polaris. I'm Margie Menzel.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, another officer-involved shooting in Fort Walton Beach is raising questions about use of force training in Florida. Body cam footage shows an Okaloosa County Sheriff's deputy fatally shooting a U.S. airman inside his apartment as the airman held a gun down by his side. Adrian Andrews spoke with an expert to learn when deadly force is necessary and what some activists are saying about the incident. We do have a warning. The story contains the sound of gunfire.
The Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office has been under national scrutiny for what some see as a problematic use of force. The latest incident took place on May 3rd involving senior airman Roger Fortson and a sheriff deputy who has yet to be identified. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump likens Fortson's death to the killings of Breonna Taylor and Trayvon Martin.
We've seen it far too many times when they kill people, especially black people, unjustifiably. They have the investigation go on for months, years. Well, we're not going to let them sweep Roger Folsom under the rug.
Body cam footage of the incident shows the Okaloosa deputy responding to Fortson's apartment after receiving a call about a disturbance between a man verbally abusing a woman. Fortson, however, was alone. The footage released by the sheriff's department shows Fortson opening the door after the deputy knocked and introduced himself multiple times. It's not clear whether Fortson heard the knocking. The 23-year-old was holding a gun with it pointing downwards, and before giving commands to drop it, the deputy opened fire.
Step out. Drop the gun! Drop the gun!
Unfortunately, de-escalation does not always work.
Brent Leffler is the training director for the Georgia Sheriff's Association. He has not seen the footage, but says from his 20-year experience of training deputies on proper use of force that not every police-involved shooting is the same. He says in most cases, it boils down to the safety of the officer and others nearby.
A lot of times you got individuals outside playing, doing yard work, whatever. Well, depending on the situation, those individuals could be placed at just a greater risk of being shot or injured.
Not everyone's buying the deputy's actions. Noted civil rights attorney Ben Crump is representing Fortson's family. He says the deputy shot prematurely. Crump says the fact Fortson had his gun pointing downward toward the floor while in his own apartment negates the deputy's claim of self-defense. And Sabu Williams with the Okaloosa NAACP is calling for the sheriff's office to release certain legal documents. He says he's interested in knowing how they've handled deputy shootings in the past.
When we force people to take a look back and look over, you know, complaints, disciplinary actions, termination records, and lawsuits that have been filed, and all these kind of things, and look at it from a, you know, from a different view, from maybe like a larger view.
Last November, the same department was in the hot seat after a deputy by the name of Jesse Hernandez mistook the sound of an acorn falling on his patrol vehicle for gunshots and opened fire on the vehicle while Marquise Jackson, a black man, was in the back seat handcuffed.
Shots fired!
The Okaloosa deputy and his partner fired 22 rounds at the vehicle. Hernandez resigned from the force a month later while under investigation. As for Jackson, he and his lawyers sued the sheriff's office for, quote, unjustifiable use of deadly force. Jackson made the announcement in March.
Imagine being shot at a tremendous amount of times while handcuffed in the backseat of a cop car by the ones we call to protect our community.
With Jackson's case pending and the family of Roger Fortson still awaiting answers from state investigators, several human rights groups have asked the state to do more to help police better protect Floridians. Okaloosa's NAACP wants agencies to host community engagement sessions and focus more on de-escalation tactics. In Florida, only sworn law enforcement officers must complete 40 hours of use of force, human diversity, and racial profiling training every 4 years. NAACP's Sabu Williams says that needs to change.
The laws need to change in order to protect people. There should be no reason why this young airman was killed. He did nothing wrong.
I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Casey Chapter, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jenny Stiletovich and Jessica Massaros. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.